With your help, we can continue to fight for freedom, reach new audiences, and bring important information to the public free of charge. This is not possible without your generosity. Join our quest for the truth and our freedom and donate today. Simply go to tntradio.live. Perspective with Jesse Zurawell on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
Welcome to Perspective. I'm Jesse Zurawell, your host for the hour. With me today is Issa Bloomy. Issa is an associate professor in the Department of Asian and Middle Eastern Studies at Stockholm University. He is a historian and he is the author of multiple books, the most recent of which is Destroying Yemen, What Chaos in Arabia Tells Us About the World. Issa, it's good to have you back on the program. How are you, brother?
So glad to hear your voice, Jesse. It's wonderful to be back. We're doing well, thank you, even though the weather is very cold and gloomy here and in low countries. But again, just hearing your voice brightens things up.
Well, likewise, very much likewise. Last week, I covered Egypt's ongoing sale of its state assets, which is happening for a number of reasons. And one of the effects of this that I examined is how this is leading to so-called innovative finance being introduced in Egypt, particularly in the form of putting smallholder farmers on blockchain in the name of reducing climate change, in the name of achieving net zero. But it's not just that that's going on. There are a lot of moving parts. With regard to the sales of Egypt's state assets, in summary, as Bloomberg reported on July 11th, Egypt agreed to sell $1.9 billion of state assets to local firms and Abu Dhabi wealth fund ADQ, helping boost the country's dollar bonds with a signal of progress in reviving an economy crippled by a foreign currency crunch. All that said, I want to ask you for your take, your assessment on what we're looking at here.
It's a old story and a new book cover, or let's say a new edition. For Egypt, long seen as a geostrategic prize for its, of course, location, its historical importance in garnering collective sentiments towards pan-Arabism, Arab, what we call Arab nationalism, often heralded as the leader, if you will, culturally of the Arabic-speaking world and a major player in African politics, despite its considerable poverty and the wealth distribution is only getting worse. The disparity between the very rich, the very poor, just gets bigger and bigger with the Sisi government, especially after taking over power from Morsi several years ago in another engineered coup. And one of the things that, interestingly enough, the Muslim Brotherhood-led government initiated right after the so-called Arab Spring Tahrir Square events, in which did see an election and the voting in of the once banned Muslim Brotherhood parties and other religious-based parties, was the pushing and pursuit of liberalization of the Egyptian economy. Now, this is important because Nasser's very often celebrated period did create a windfall for certain Egyptian families who did secure large numbers of foreign-owned properties that had been accumulated since at least British occupation in 1882. Egyptian assets, despite being increasingly devalued or in the global market and not very competitive, these properties themselves do have inherent value to them. And some of the problems with popular politics in Egypt is that you could not easily pursue liberal reforms that include the privatization of state assets. In large part, which is something we forget, that it's the military that was largely the beneficiary of the so-called state acquiring private assets in the 1950s. Again, a lot of powerful Egyptian families did very well under Nasser, and they secured also considerable amounts of confiscated foreign-owned properties. And they have largely lived to survive the transition from the tumultuous Nasser period to the Sadat and then subsequent military dictatorships until Sisi today. But what's really up for sale now, apparently, is something that cannot no longer just simply be squeezed from the poor. The poor, the so-called fellahin or the peasantry of Egypt, have long bear the burden of Egyptians' agreements with the IMF in forms of austerity that led to the depletion of services that the state once provided. There is basically no funds for retirees anymore. The public services, from transport to healthcare, are egregious. Education is a huge bifurcation, quality of education. Anyone who has money goes private now if they don't send their kids overseas entirely. And this whole phenomenon of small farmers, this is a little bit overstated in some of the media. There are not many small farmers left in Egypt. They've been bullied a long time ago to surrendered their lands, or they have been overburdened by debt. But that too has been a process of feeding the wolves, if you will, while the military, the very powerful military, continued to hold on to some of the most, most inefficient of Egypt's industries that nevertheless produced revenue for them. It secured state funding from the state coffers, and the generals and the colonels did continue to live very comfortably, thank you very much. And that's why they staged coups when necessary. This is why they held their nose to this transition, what we call the Arab Spring. And the Morsi government unleashed this IMF-approved kind of regime of austerity that was just simply added on the poor. So higher bread prices, higher fuel prices, More state assets that were providing subsidized electricity and other things were semi-privatized. So what is happening now with Sisi is that not only are they acquiring new lands to build their new metropolis in the new capital north of Cairo, not only are they acquiring new lands very much like the Gulf countries in respect to transferring them into revenue-producing or at least rent-producing properties as opposed to simply farmlands that feed people, or even they confiscating lands that belong to mosques. And most notoriously, was ongoing when I was last in Egypt and we talked in the one show there, they've been actually taking over grave sites and bulldozing down some of the most famous places of burial in order to make way for toll-bearing roads or make way for new apartment blocks. So this is the form of selling assets that was going on before this latest stage. The currency crisis in Egypt has made it another perfect opportunity to push for even more a fire sale of a new kind that includes some of these high ticket assets, whether it be in the gas, in the energy, certainly in property, ripping up old protection laws, environmental laws, protecting poor neighborhoods from development that would have made their housing too expensive to sustain. So this is what we're beginning to see now with this new crisis that was more or less something that was predictable. My suspicion is that a lot of the military are not aware of what's going to happen with their pension funds, that those companies that are now going to be privatized, there'll be some generals who profit handsomely from this, but the majority of the, the grunts, I guess that's the terminology one uses about those who join the military or stay in the military with the expectation that they'll have a a pension at the end of the day are going to one day find out that that has all gone away. That has all been spirited away by international investors, the Gulf primarily, or Israeli investors who, through the Gulf, are investing in new sectors of the Egyptian economy, thanks to the likes of Sisi and these corrupt generals who, Sisi is one of them, of course, right? He comes from the military. So that's what we're seeing here with this story from Bloomberg. It's now the beginning of selling of some prime properties, prime businesses that are held by the military, not from enterprises that had long ago been privatized to powerful Egyptian families or already to other enterprises that were associated with foreigners in the last 10 or so years, thanks to the Morsi government. So it's the poor who are being crushed. They're being crushed by bad currency exchanges. There's a suppression of an attempt to work this currency crisis to the benefit of some actors on the streets. There's a lot of persecution of people who are trying to somehow survive in the rapidly declining capacity of the Egyptian pound to purchase imports. It's basically impossible for the poor to do anything but rely on increasingly expensive bread that is supposedly subsidized by the state. So we've been seeing that already, outbursts of violence when bread prices have gone too high. Indeed, 2011 is in large part because bread prices were too high. Subsidies for the poor and other elements of their lives were taken away from them. And on top of that, the middle class lost a hell of a lot of money in the investment markets, especially in the equity markets or stock exchange. And that middle class is gone. There's really not a middle class. There's the rich, there's the medium rich, and then there are the rest of the Egyptians, which is, I would say, 90% of the population, if not more.
Mm-hmm.
So that includes, again, also, yeah, sorry about that. Just quickly, I just remind you that so state assets like hotels, also tourism is going to be the really only cash earner for Egypt moving forward, as they're going to be selling off their gas, if they haven't done so already, to Israelis, thanks to Camp David Accords. But those kinds of things are going to be now in the hands of global actors that are in parts represented by these Gulf funds. So sorry about interrupting, Jesse. Just wanted to highlight, again, tourism, which is the only thing that Egypt has outside of gas and petroleum, is now going to be fully privatized and, let's say, exported.
No problem at all. I'm glad you brought that up. I'm glad you brought up tourism, because real estate, property, the building of this new capital, which is going to be kitted out with smart infrastructure, sensor technology, that's what we're looking at in the present and in the very near future for Egypt and for many, many other places in the world. And this is part of what I continually talk about as the transformation of the international monetary and financial system. And this allows for the injection of so-called innovative financial tools, like putting smallholder farmers on blockchain through the UN development program. Tourism, real estate, property, that whole sector, those sectors which can be combined into one big sector, I argue, that is the future of Egypt. That's what we're looking at here. And again, many other places, including Abu Dhabi, which is buying up many of Egypt's state assets. The ADQ is a sovereign wealth fund, if I'm not mistaken. And you alluded to these wealth funds essentially going berserk nowadays. And I want to get into that. A few things, though. Egypt imports 60% of its food, according to this Bloomberg article. Now, correct me if I'm wrong, it has more than enough capacity to produce its own food and feed its own people. Also, this Bloomberg article mentions the Egyptian state's attempts to fulfill the terms of a $3 billion deal with the International Monetary Fund. I'd like to get your take on that. And then move into these wealth funds, that one of which is mentioned in this article, but there are many others. There are Saudi wealth funds that are seeing massive inflows and outflows, especially over the last year. And these play a big part in what we're talking about here in terms of immiserating huge swaths of people in the Arab world, but again, in much of the world at this point. So can you address those, what I just cobbled together there?
Yeah, sure. The fire economy, like in many other parts of the world, is the main game in town in Egypt. They, again, tried a period of time of import substitution industrialization. They do have the capacity. They do make cars, for instance, in Egypt. Labor is cheap enough. There is a huge market. It's over 120 million people in Egypt. The streets have never been as crowded with newer cars than now. Obviously, all purchased on credits that was readily available for a time. Credit that was ultimately now being used as a hook to lure certain segments of the expanded middle tier of Egyptian workforce. I wouldn't call them middle class because their capacity to purchase things are much more limited than traditional middle class we would find in the post-industrial world. But the rapacious appetite for land has long been a problem for Egypt. Egypt used to export food to the larger world. Historically, Egypt fed Southern Europe, right? We wouldn't have a French revolution in the 18th century without French grain merchants, Egyptian grain merchants basically cutting the spivot off to the grains that were coming to Marseille because the French monarchy couldn't pay for those shipments, and so on and so forth. And the increasing demand for land for land development, but more importantly, the consolidation of farms. Again, the idea that there are small farmers in Egypt is no longer really it's really not a game anymore to play in terms of sociology and assessing what is happening in Egyptian rural society. There's been so much consolidation of land that used to produce food for the consumption of everyone in Egypt to cash crops. And again, this is a universal problem that has been going on since the United Nations had been established, the pursuit of rational use of land. Why are you growing grains here to sell in local markets? There are some very special grains that are unique to Egypt, and they have unique breads that are made from these grains. Well, you have these jerk-offs coming from University of Chicago who are saying, you can get perfectly good subsidized cheap grains from the United States. They're even offering it for free as aid, which unfortunately what Nasser actually embraced. People forget that Nasser and Kennedy agreed to this relationship that Egypt now is dependent on imports of especially grains, which is a disaster mm-hmm. because Egyptians are heavily dependent on bread. The quality of life in Egypt since the 1970s has significantly dropped. The stuff that you can find for sale now in supermarkets or in the corner stores is just awful. Most of it's imported. It's actually because the lands that are available and being used for farming are being used for exports. You can buy Egyptian apples, for goodness sake, or Egyptian oranges in the Gulf. Now, that doesn't benefit any small farmers. I guarantee you that. It's some probably some oligarch who owns huge swaths of the Delta region in Egypt, and the or the, as I mentioned previously, the military companies, the companies owned by the military that are managing these properties. And now these are going to be sold off, and more than likely, these lands are going to be seen by investors like those in Abu Dhabi, who are in many ways, but I have to highlight here, and people are not paying attention. But since these Abrahamic Accords, a lot of infiltration from Israeli citizens now in Abu Dhabi financial markets. They're managing a lot of the assets of these wealth funds, in, especially in UAE. I wouldn't be surprised in Saudi Arabia either. Bahrain has notoriously succumbed to the fixation on bringing Israelis to make Bahrain economy somehow better. The former finance minister, Moshe Kahlon, for instance, moved to Bahrain. He's now managing Bahrain's wealth fund. He's he's involved in all kinds of investment schemes that help bring people together. And they come to put these packages together for these very exploitative, aggressive investment schemes that ride the wave of immiseration of local population. It's happened in Lebanon. They tried to do this in Syria. I'm sure that now that Syria has been rehabilitated, it's going to be a fire sale for a lot of its assets. A lot of destroyed properties will just simply be sold off for cash, seemingly cash. And Egypt has fallen down that track a long time ago already. So who are these wealth funds? Again, I think the personalities behind them are crucial to understand this new wave of aggressive investment, which is both using as collateral the supposed future revenues of these societies in the Gulf, their credit rating, and more importantly, develop properties in their countries. So Abu Dhabi develops Sadarat Island, for instance, and has nice fancy hotels and golf courses. That is used as collateral for further capital to come into the wealth fund to then start these investments in London property, or in the case of Egypt, some of the state companies, these military-owned companies. And again, they're largely being manned now by Israeli citizens. And that's for, I think, should be a huge, huge issue for a lot of principled people who are still hostile to this whole push from Abu Dhabi, from this particular branch of the ruling family in Abu Dhabi, who steered the entire federation towards a positive relationship with Israel. A business partnership, more or less, that are where a lot of money from the sovereign wealth fund of not only Abu Dhabi, but of Dubai, of the whole federation, a lot of money that's coming from these other smaller emirates are now being held or held hostage by these asset managers in Abu Dhabi. And they're simply now plundering the rest of the poor world with these assets. And who is actually going to benefit from them? If in fact they're going to ever see a positive return in these investments, is something that workers in the United States from various unions or workers now here in Europe are beginning to realize it really doesn't matter, because their pension funds have basically been eliminated. All that money that has been accumulated by their sending money off to a pension fund for their retirement has all vanished. It's all gone into these kinds of schemes. The first ones to push this initiative is not the Gulf. It was happening here in the West, in Europe, and especially in the United States. And it's many of your listeners know all too well what happened to and what you're being forewarned about, how it's not sustainable. The pension funds in the United States is something that in the next generation, they're not going to benefit from on these guaranteed revenue for retirement. And that applies to these wealth funds in Abu Dhabi. Again, with the help of managers coming from Wall Street or from the City of London, their jobs are the jobs of the 19th century colonial administrators to plunder any meaningful
Silicon Valley as well.
Silicon Valley. Any meaningful pools of wealth that exist out beyond the control of the oligarchs, like the City of London, or Wall Street, and these days Shanghai, are going to gobble it up. And these schemes, they need some local partners. It's much easier to do that than have wage war, as they did in Iraq, where they basically confiscated physical assets, right? Well, you don't have to do that in places like the Gulf. The Gulf facilitates, just like China. You didn't have to go to war with China. You can actually just work and partner with Deng Xiaoping and every guy since. And they've done basically the same thing to the Chinese peasantry as the Egyptian military class has done to the Egyptian peasantry. Egypt was a very rich and powerful country in the middle of the 19th century. Very rich. Most powerful state until the 1840s in all of the Mediterranean world. More powerful than any one European state. And faced the gauntlet of collaboration of the Atlantic world, as did China, the same period with the Opium Wars, and as did India. These places have already surrendered. They've already been bled for trillions and trillions and trillions of dollars of wealth that has flowed to the West and subsidized places like here in the Netherlands or England or the United States. And the new forms of wealth extend to financial gimmicks that, yet again, I mean, carbon credits, what the hell is that? Egyptian farmers are supposedly now going to, get into carbon credit markets. Are you kidding me? That's yet again another kind of financial kind of tool that is going to be used to further consolidate land ownership in the hands of a very few. And again, they see long-term benefits of developing these things for mega hotels or for new cities that probably will never be finished. My prediction about the Egyptian capital and the Indonesian capital, for that matter, they are envisioned to be smart cities, but the way they're moving forward with the quality of life for Egyptians, I don't foresee 95% of the Egyptians ever being able to go and actually visit the capital city. It's going to be one of those phenomena where they're going to be left to die of disease and hunger and anger and internal fighting, while this sequestered neighborhoods, which you already have in Cairo and Alexandria, that you already have gated communities that are been pushed off into the desert, avoiding the traffic and the pollution of historical Cairo. And there's just a simple
extension. That brings up an important question in terms of the scalability of these smart city projects and their technologies and their financial mechanisms. Now, there are people and entities who are certainly trying to scale these up to large populations, and they need large populations as inputs, if you will, for those cities and those technologies and the data they want to acquire and then use to steer behavior and commodify behavior. But whether or not that can be scaled up to massive populations like that of Egypt is a whole other question. The point to take home, though, is that, again, people and entities are certainly trying to do this, and whether they succeed or fail, they are immiserating billions of people in the process. And in terms of these wealth funds, again, it's not just Egypt being targeted. There are many other countries being targeted, and one of them is Turkey. And it's not just that Turkey's being targeted or Egypt's being targeted. These wealth funds are invited in by certain parties. I want to move to Turkey, but before we do, let's take a quick break and pick up on that when we come back. So everybody hang tight, and I will return after this pause with Issa Bloomy here on TNT Radio.
Rick Munn on TNT Radio.
Word on the street is that Musk could be dipping his toes into the UK energy market. Farage, being Farage, of course, has got his nose firmly wedged in Musk's rectum, and he's begging him to come over and set up in the UK and give us all cheaper energy, because let's face it, who doesn't want cheaper energy at this point? So whether or not this is Nigel giving us forewarning of what is about to happen, or simply fantasizing on his Twitter feed, I don't know.
If we could make solar power panels efficient enough and sustainable enough, because they're not sustainable, they create terrible waste, and once they're used, they can't be reused or recycled. But if we can get around some of those issues, which Musk talks about, then that is a way in the future when no one will have to pay for electricity, because everybody will be generating their own electricity. So you can imagine that in the future, but I think that's quite far off.
Rick Munn is locked and loaded on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
When you can point me to an industry, to a platform that reaches 250 million people a month, virtually 9 out of 10 Americans, that's real, that's substantive, that's important. And that reach and that touch point and that daily reinforcement, it's an amazing place to be able to communicate messages. That's massive.
To find out more, go to tntradio.live.
This is Jesse Zurawell and Perspective on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
Welcome back to Perspective here on TNT Radio, where we are live 24/7. I'm Jesse Zurawell, and I'm speaking with Issa Bloomy. So Issa, these sovereign wealth funds like ADQ and others are targeting slash being invited into countries like Egypt as well as Turkey. And right now, Turkey is in talks to sell its Izmir port operating rights to Gulf investors. Those Gulf investors have not been disclosed, but Erdogan was recently on a tour of Gulf countries, including the UAE, Saudi, and Qatar, and may still be on that tour. I don't know if it's finished yet, but he was very recently in the UAE and signed over $50 billion worth of deals, as TradeArabia.com puts it. But when you read the report itself, these are MOUs, memorandums of understanding, memoranda of understanding, I should say. So not written stone, but when you get into what the agreements exchanged included, there's some very interesting content. An agreement between the government of the UAE and the government of Turkey, as it's written in this report, on reciprocal promotion and protection of investments, a joint declaration on the establishment of a joint economic and trade commission, or JETCO, a memorandum of understanding between the Ministry of Industry and Technology of Turkey and the Ministry of Industry and Advanced Technology of the UAE on collaboration in the field of digital transformation. And digital transformation, I encourage people to read as the transformation, or part of the transformation, of the international monetary and financial system toward digital technology, digital currencies, etc. A strategic partnership framework agreement signed between the Ministry of Industry and Energy and Natural Resources of Turkey and the Ministry of Investment of the UAE to develop energy and natural resources projects. Much of that energy and the natural resources will be needed for the digital transformation. Also, a memorandum of understanding on the development of joint launch vehicle capabilities for commercial purposes between the UAE Space Agency, the Turkish Ministry of Science, Industry, and Technology, and the Turkish Space Agency. And so the UAE Space Agency and the Turkish Space Agency, I might have said the Turkish one twice. To me, this is not so much about space exploration as it is about satellites and other technology in the sky that is part of the digital transformation. There's also a memorandum of understanding in the field of export credit financing between Abu Dhabi Developmental Holding Company, ADQ, again, and Turkish Exim Bank. A memorandum of understanding on investing in sukuk, which are Islamic bonds, simply put, for the purposes of reconstruction of areas of Turkey affected by earthquakes between ADQ again and the Turkish Ministry of Treasury and Finance. And lastly, there are others, but this is the last one I'll point out, a strategic cooperation between the Abu Dhabi National Oil Company, ADNOC, and the Turkish Petroleum Corporation. Again, in large part, I argue to power the digital transformation, but for other construction projects as well. So your take on what's going on here in Turkey, and it's getting closer with the UAE, other parties in the Gulf as well.
This is it could have been a geostrategic bomb shell. It could be read as one. A couple people in Washington could be hyperventilating over what this suggests. And I would suggest paying close attention, if that's possible, or what are some of the official statements coming from Qatar. Because some of these technical agreements between especially ministries of trade and oil and other things related to energy had originally been signed with Qatar in Turkey. They were in collaboration to tear apart Syria and large parts of Iraq and create a conduit to deliver Gulf, especially gas, to the European markets via maybe an Islamic State of some form, maybe an entirely, let's say, free Syrian state without the Baathists, through Turkey as the major beneficiary for being an intermediary in this process. But that didn't work out, right? We had a war that's still going on. We have the Americans playing their own cards in eastern Syria and taking over a lot of those assets. It's not clear that who's on whose side anymore along the frontiers of that conflict. Turkey is in trouble as a financial enterprise. The currency has devalued increasingly since even after Erdogan's re-election, and that's over the long term is going to cause instability. So those kinds of collaborations is indeed, and if you have a sense of what was happening over the last 15 years, shocking. It does indicate some serious shifts in power in the region, in which Turkey is on the weak side. They don't have leverage at this stage. They're losing their control over the narrative about what's happening in the Middle East. I mean, Erdogan himself even held his nose to coming to Egypt and bringing his entourage to talk to Sisi, who, for political reasons, is just a disaster for Turkey. If you consider that political Islam, support of Muslim Brotherhood, affiliated parties throughout the Arab world was their forte. And that's what made the UAE and Turkey arch enemies at a strategic level. Now, at a commercial level, with short periods of time in which Turkish Airlines was not allowed to fly there, and some actors were deported from the UAE. There are a hell of a lot of the Turks inside the UAE and working quite fine in the economy. The Emiratis love Turkish food. They love going to Turkey for vacation. So there are a lot of elements that make this kind of agreement not surprising if you ignore these geostrategic calculations that were made over the last 15 years. But it also means that Qatar is losing out, I would suggest, if indeed these MOUs end up becoming actually real investments that divert Turkish, resources to allowing for UAE-backed funnels of energy to flow through Turkey to European markets. That could be a major loss for Qatar moving forward.
To give some context to that, as EmiratesNBDResearch.com points out, and this is the website for the state, the official state commercial bank for the UAE, Emirates NBD. A report they released this month about foreign direct investment inflows and outflows in 2022 states that Qatar saw the smallest inflows within the GCC bloc, with $76 million, amounting to a 107% decline year over year. And that's at the same time, Qatar experienced a 1,391% year over year surge in terms of FDI outflows. So financially, Qatar seems to be, in trouble.
As are all the Gulf countries. We've been saying this now for a long time on your show, and there's constant reports reminding us that the Saudis, the UAE, various Emirates are always trying to issue IPOs and trying to generate new revenue flows and creating a buzz. And my suspicion is that these MOUs are just meant to create a buzz about the viability of the Turkish economy. I don't think that, who knows? I mean, I think it would be a political disaster for a lot of actors who are beneath Erdogan as he now goes and rides towards the sunset of his political career. I mean, there was a lot of political capital raised on standing up for justice, standing up behind Muslim brothers around the Arab world, to now to capitulate and work so bluntly. Again, it hasn't been materialized. But what for me was the most outstanding agreement that actually was an agreement, not just something that promises that we will talk about it further in the future, what these MOUs are. What they actually came to an agreement is that we're going to work together in the legal sense and actually agree to deport wanted people from our mutual countries. So they agreed to basically allow Turkey or the UAE to persecute certain actors who go and have found safe haven in their respective countries. Now, that's very interesting, especially for the UAE, because some of the most notorious people they've been going after are actually advocates of the Muslim Brotherhood in the UAE. I mean, they've been for a long time terrified of Islamic fundamentalism in their country, and they've been persecuting and trying to. And a lot of them ended up in Turkey in exile. And a lot of Syrians who are persona non grata in Syria are also in exile in Turkey. Now, if Turkey is willing to send some of them back to Egypt or send some of them to Saudi Arabia or to the UAE, that changes the dynamic entirely of Turkey's relationship with their main, say, human assets in the region moving forward. And I find that quite interesting. Turkey is also scrambling for relevance in the Balkans again. It's obviously constantly plays the Black Sea in its relationship to Russia. And there's, you know, this little petty profit-taking from seeing flows of Russian oil and gas going through their country and working with Iran for cheap plastic-made Chinese things. So there are all kinds of things that at the personal level, those who have secured certain portfolios in commanding the Turkish economy, they're continuously to make some money in a very corrupt way. But at the macro level, Turkey...
Well, as an example of that with regard to the war in Ukraine, on the one hand, we have Turkey very interested in Crimea because there's a population of Crimean Tatars there, and they have a link to Turkey. And also, Turkey right now has started construction of a factory in Ukraine for the production of its Bayraktar drones. And this comes on the heels of in concert with humiliation after humiliation that Turkey is dishing out to Russia. Recently, Turkey released 5 Azov commanders to Zelensky when he was visiting with Erdogan, and these Azov commanders who were captured at Azovstal last year, last May, were first supposed to be sentenced to death, and then they were released in an exchange for the Ukrainian oligarch who's Putin's friend, Medvedchuk. And these Azov commanders were supposed to stay in Turkey as a part of an arranged deal, and they were just let go after Zelensky met with Erdogan. And so you have that, you have the construction of this factory, which there must be an agreement that Russia is not going to hit this factory. And there are many other things to point out, but in terms of leverage, it seems that Turkey does have leverage over Russia.
One would interpret it that way, yes. But then if you look at Turkey's relationship and attempts to create new kinds of economic opportunities by signing deals with, but we're virtually the devil in their own rhetoric, right? Sisi was the most evil aggressor against Muslim rights in all the world, in most of Turkish press. And now they're all quiet about this now rehabilitation. And it could probably go to the extent of rehabilitating Assad at some point, I suppose, if the realpolitik kicks in. Another sad side of this is this agreement to promote and push for collaborating on pooling the Sukuk, the resources gathered from well-meaning, faithful Muslims who refuse to work through the donation systems of banks because of interest. They issue interest, so they have charities that are supposedly compliant to Islamic law. Now you see the Turkish government making agreements with the most egregiously abusive one could argue non-Muslim actor in the Middle East at this stage, the UAE, the UAE's wealth fund, which is again is completely inhabited by Israeli bankers at this stage, to actually put their hands into this pool of resources from donations that were steered towards relief for victims of these earthquakes, just gives you another example of the seedy side of government. It's not just Joe Biden, Hunter Biden, the Trumps, and the American equivalents, or their Australian or UK equivalents. You have them in the Eastern Mediterranean world as well. And Erdogan's the macro, the structure, the larger structure of that enterprise that he has built, mostly on debt, mostly on very shoddy, kind of like the Chinese model of getting hardworking Turks from the diaspora, Muslims from around the world to embrace the Turkish government and Erdogan's government, especially as the leading Muslim force moving forward. You can trust by putting your money in the Turkish economy. And that's now falling apart. And maybe there's going to be a scramble of using the kind of technology that they are able to acquire from Chinese Israeli companies. Because again, we have to remember, Turkey and Israel have always been very good allies, and sometimes very publicly and sometimes more secretly. So I think there's going to be a push for more surveillance. There has been a lot of complaints in Turkey itself about people being taken off the streets for activism regarding the economic crisis, regarding the corruption of the Erdogan government. The elections were proven to be very suspicious. Erdogan has also embraced Turkish nationalism, these gray wolf groups, especially in the diaspora throughout here in Western Europe, all major supporters of Erdogan and all huge nationalists who, you know, embrace Azerbaijan's encirclement of Armenian enclaves at the moment, which is starving them into submission, to throwing out all the Arabs from Turkey. There's been a huge wave of xenophobia, anti-Arab xenophobia in Turkey in the last year. So there is a shift. There is a calculated shift that Erdogan has quietly been pursuing, and therefore scrubbing his historic, let's say, links to certain rhetoric that identified the Sisi's and the UAE's of the Middle East as enemies, and Qatar as the primary ally moving forward. So that doesn't bode well for actors inside Turkey who've come to Turkey is seeking safe haven to continuously pursue their projects, whether it be in Yemen or in Egypt or in Libya or in Somalia or indeed at the Gulf. It also, for me, means that Turkey is going to go through even more greater economic problems in moving forward. The UAE's wealth fund and those who are investing Izmir port are just going to do what they did to Athens port, what the Chinese do around the world. They're just going to find a way to profit from that transfer of operation rights. And the moment that thing that goes wrong, they're not going to subsidize that moving forward. And it's just going to be a disaster for Turkish workers, for any small Turkish businesses. They're going to be pushed out. Globalization continues. Turkey was once a brave, let's say, resilient, authoritarian society that maintains domestic control of their industries. That has, under Erdogan's time, slowly moved to being integrated into the global economy. So it's a very interesting set of stories you brought up this week about Egypt, about Turkey, and the importance of these wealth funds, which, again, it's just simply plundering the savings of the people of the UAE. They all expect to have almost $1 trillion of assets sitting there when it's time, when a rainy day comes, and they're going to expect to be able to have tap into that. Well, they're already realizing they're facing austerity. They're paying more for their gasoline. They're paying huge amount inflation rates in property, in food. So they're not in any ways living a better life in the UAE. Things are getting rougher for the for let's say 95% of the people, even those very rich ones that seem to be very rich. They're all teetering on financial disaster because they've over leveraged with debt. And so this scenario in which these Gulf countries have huge amounts of savings and cash is being marketed in order to keep money flowing into certain arenas. And I think Turkey is desperate to try to somehow stop the hemorrhaging, as probably Qatar is, but they have no choice now. They're even losing their Turkish asset, it seems, at this stage. Doha these days is very quiet. After the World Cup, no one's going to Doha anymore. And unless they see a huge spike in liquefied natural gas prices, they're going to face some problems with Qatar, which has interesting implications in places like Yemen, where Qatari Turkish assets are floundering. It's the war between the Emirati and Saudi assets now that are really shaping what's going on in southern Yemen. And I suspect that's also at play in other parts of the Middle East, where there was this triangle of actors pursuing their own interests, whether it be the Qatar-Turkish alliance, the Saudis themselves, and then the Emiratis. They're all now reconfiguring and reconsidering their interests. And clearly, UAE have joined forces with the Israelis, who are facing their own domestic politics issues right now, but that's another story. Can I just end this session with the news? Very good news as an academic.
Sure.
The AAAs, the American Anthropological Association, has declared and has voted to boycott working with Israeli academic institutions, and that was based on a 71% approval of the motion. Which means there is an academic a body at the moment in the United States which has taken the step to actually separate their relationship with Israeli academic institutions. So whether that leads to a snowball effect or that leads to a series of people getting fired in the American universities is something to watch moving forward. But I just wanted to alert your audience. Just check American Anthropology Association, their website. They explain what happened. And it's something that, again, in regards to Palestine, that's the only way moving forward that there's going to be any justice brought to that beautiful but very sad land. And I suspect that this gesture could be a way forward for others to take the bold step and of actually doing what is right. So just to bring that news to the program.
Great. Thank you for sharing that. That is good news, and good news is far and few between these days, yeah. But that is some, and you're absolutely right. That is the way forward in terms of dismantling the Zionist occupation of Palestine, boycotting, divestment. I hesitate to say sanctions because that implies economic warfare, but boycotting, divesting, not buying into their colonialist genocidal project is the very least we can do as individuals and as organizations, as the American Anthropological Association is seemingly demonstrating. Issa, thank you so much for joining me this week. It was very good to have you back, and I hope that we can join forces again next week.
Inshallah. All the best to you and your listeners.
Take care. And that's it for me, for everybody. I'll be back at the same time tomorrow. Joe Hoft up next here on TNT Radio.